Hey guys, I'm Adam Rapport. This is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we have on Ivan Orkin and Chris Ying, co-authors of The Gaijin Cookbook, Japanese recipes from a chef, father, eater, and lifelong outsider. Ivan is the owner and chef of two Ivan Ramens here in New York City. Used to live in Japan, where he operated two very successful ramen restaurants and got a widely celebrated reputation as like the one American guy who could open a ramen restaurant and succeed in Tokyo. And Chris is the co-founder and former editor of The Late Lucky Peach, RIP. He is the author of last year's You and I Eat the Same, and he is a big honcho over at David Chang's Majordomo Media. I chat with both of them about the book and how it came to be. After that, Carla Music is in the studio for our final, at least for now, installment of our Test Kitchen Editor's Top 10 Cooking Rules. But before we get started, we are celebrating our annual list of the Hot 10, the best new restaurants in America, with a massive party on Saturday, October 19th. The chef and owners of all 10 of this year's restaurants will come together for an over-the-top bash. There will be endless food from each of the restaurants, plus an open bar featuring wine, beer, and spirits. And you will have first access to limited edition BA merch. And you will get to hang with the whole BA crew. Yes, both Brad and Claire will be there, and I'll be there, and Molly and Andy and Carla. The whole gang. Buy tickets now at bahot10.com, bahot10.com. We promise it'll be a night to remember. All right, let's do this. What did each of you guys have to eat so far today?
Nothing, because I intermittent fast as best I can, so I try to eat not that much every day. I had a piece of gum.
What?
Yeah. I eat like 5 to 7 hours a day.
You eat five? What do you mean? Oh, you're saying?
So I start eating at 2 p.m., finish at 8 or 9, and that's all I eat.
You're the worst.
That was Chris saying you're the worst. That was Ivan talking originally. So I don't understand. Explain this theory to me. So how does this work?
Are you all right? Really? You don't You live in New York and you don't know the hipster diet of the moment?
I subscribe to the Greeks. I just, moderation, you know? Right. I try not to snack all day.
And how old are you?
49.
Okay, well, I'm 56. Yeah. So you're, okay. We're not that far
apart. No,
but it catches up fast.
You know what I've done? I've really cut down on my sugar intake the last couple of years.
Yeah, I have too.
How are you looking at Adam Rapoport right now and trying to talk to him about health and lifestyle? Look at this guy. He's
what
like a
mean?
Greek god.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I look at him.
That's what I meant when talking about the Greeks, like Adonis and stuff. Yeah.
I follow what my father Zeus did.
Yeah.
Look at this guy,
he's
man.
Skinny, man.
You can't teach
he's
him about intermittent.
Skinny.
You know,
that's
I had to. You know,
what
I ate this morning.
It.
I ate the rest of that hoagie from last night.
Ooh, let's talk about that.
Ooh, the Ivan, the corner slice,
like a 9-pound hoagie on house made. What is that thing called?
Oh, it was a semolina roll that we're hero that we're making right now.
Yeah, and what's in there?
Oh my God, there's all. I mean, all kinds of Italian.
I don't know.
It was cold cuts.
This is made by you and your people
at Corner Slice at our pizza place in the Gotham Market, and it's a really good version.
Yeah, the heartburn feels incredible right now.
I don't get heartburn.
My whole chest is on fire.
Wow, maybe you're dying.
Did it have shredded iceberg in there?
It had shredded iceberg that had gotten nice and soggy overnight.
Yeah.
You know, just so it was like
wet confetti.
It was totally wet confetti. It felt like cooked bok choy.
The
by
problem
this morning.
With an Italian hero like that is you say that you're just gonna have a bite or two, and then you just have like an empty wrapper.
Well, you're gonna at least eat a half.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We split a large sandwich, and Chris actually, I think Chris forgot about it. I don't think it was that he didn't want to eat the whole thing. He forgot.
I knew specifically that I was gonna eat it this morning. I my disgustingness is planned.
Okay. I'm gonna segue to your book and Japanese cooking. I'm gonna do this here. One thing that's really popular in Japan is QP mayonnaise. I am a big mayo guy. I will put mayo on my Italian heroes. I get a lot of flack for that on the social media and stuff. Where do you stand, Ivan?
Well, I'm exactly the same as you, except I substitute QP mayo for ketchup. So I put ketchup on everything. But
what? Wait, what? You substitute ketchup for mayo? So you put ketchup on a sub?
Well, I don't put ketchup on a sub, but
he's
I have the
if
same.
You would, where you stand on mayo on a sub?
On a hero. Will you put mayo on an Italian hero?
I think a vinaigrette is really the way to go myself.
I do a vinaigrette and mayo.
It's okay.
Chris,
these debates are in the New York imagination. We don't have sandwiches in San Francisco. We have tacos.
That's true. You don't have sandwiches in San Francisco.
We don't have sandwiches, truly.
Today's discussion, we're talking about Japanese recipes from a chef, father, eater, and lifelong outsider, the Gaijin Cookbook. Ivan Orkin and Chris Ying. I love the introduction to this book. Reading it, we learn about you, Ivan, coming to the terms with being a gaijin, living in Tokyo, the fact that your first wife passed away. We learn your three kids' names. We learn your obsession with Japanese cooking. And this is all on the first page of the book.
Right.
You guys really put it out there. How did that collaborative process work? Because you also talk about the collaborative process as a writer and chef working together.
Yeah, we do put it all out there in maybe even like one paragraph to start this book off, because we did write an entire other book about Ivan's life story and how he came to find Japan and opened two ramen shops there and then the whole deal. And this book, we really, the collaborative part of it was that we sat down in the beginning and said, like, this is going to be a book that's going to help people cook at home. This is going to be something that's actually useful. It's going to be the opposite of everything I've ever done. And so we wanted to dispense with some of those formalities.
Wait, are you saying like the 900-page Noma fermentation book wasn't super home cook friendly?
I mean, no. I can't say whether or not I've done any of the recipes from that book that I edited.
I told you this. I texted you at the time. We had on Rene Redzepi when that book came out. For a book that should have been remarkably dense, it was fascinatingly easy to read. That was I was like, wow, this book is actually fun to read, a 600-page book on fermentation.
I'll take a little credit for the funness to read. You know, I take no credit for the science or recipes in that book. But yeah, no, I mean, for as long as I've been doing this, I make stuff that is, how many backflips can you do before you make this recipe? How crazy can it be? How new and innovative and how impressed will my friends in the industry be? But Ivan and I sat down, we were like, this is going to be a book that's going to be the stuff we eat at home, and we're finally going to make something useful. So we dispensed with all that stuff super quickly and wanted to dive straight into what this book is about.
So we'll get to the food, because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about. But within the introduction, whatnot, sort of setting the table for this book, could you have written this book yourself, Ivan? Like, why did you need Chris?
Well, I'm not a writer. I mean, I'm an okay writer, and if you compare to me and maybe average people, I think I'm actually not a bad writer. But Chris is a genius. I mean, he really.
I mean, hey, come on.
No, he really is. It's not just that he's a good writer, because he's a really good writer. He can listen to a whole story and then like shuffle it so that it really makes sense. But what he does even better than that is he organizes things, and he's able to think about how the order should be so that it would make sense to people. And so I threw at Chris all kinds of ideas and recipes, all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, it's always fun for me to talk to him and then read what he's written later. And I'll read. I'm like, oh, wow, I did say that. But I said that at like a totally different time. But he put it all together. But it's none of it's gratuitous. It makes sense. And it should be where it is. And yeah. So to me, I think I like to do things really well. I really don't like doing anything that I think is not going to be the best. And I want this book to be the best Japanese cookbook ever written. And I think, while, you know, it's an obnoxious claim, so I'm not going to make it.
I'm going to say it's the best Japanese cookbook written by a Jewish guy who lives in Long Island with his Chinese-American collaborator.
Yes, you know? I would say that is accurate.
There is that other guy who lives near you in Long Island who wrote a book with a Thai co-author.
Yes. It's
a little bit better than this one.
Yes. But I think that, you know, I think part of my success in general in my life is I'm good at taking on things that I'm really good at and then delegating or sharing or collaborating on stuff that I'm not.
Well, you write about, and not only that, as the co-writer's, one of his or her big duties is to sort of channel the voice of the chef, which I think Chris does remarkably well. It really sounds like you're talking to us. But also the fact that you want that collaborator to sort of challenge you and get you to think more and put thoughts out there that you might not have sort of asked yourself if you just
been
sitting
alone. Well, no, that reminds me of back from the first book, and we were talking about when I first worked at the Japanese restaurant when I was 15. And Chris was like, so tell me, like, what were you thinking on that day that you were? And I was like, dude, I was 15. He's like, I need more information. And I'm like, but I can't remember, Chris. I was 15, you know?
Yeah, it's I think we do have to like push each other a lot, but it's ridiculous, like how annoying both of us can be on our own, and yet we don't fight. it's kind of remarkable. Like I think we have a relationship that's based on constant low level bickering, which means we don't have like a big blowout ever. you know,
because you keep it at a simmer.
Yeah, we keep it at a simmer, and it's like, you know, that it's like thriving on that conflict to some degree in like a healthy way, if that's even possible. But you know, it was, you know, Ivan wanted to do a book about Japanese cooking, and he had all these recipes and all this stuff that we wanted to do, and you know, like the organizational part for me was like, well, we can't just, I wouldn't want to buy a book that was just like Japanese recipes.
But that's, and that's, if I could interject, is that that's the problem. There's so many cookbooks, and most of them are not that valuable. They're just really lists of recipes, and which is fine. And everybody wants to have a few of those. They're not bad to have.
But I think the reader wants a relationship. They want to know who that person is who's speaking to them.
Yeah.
They want a connection.
And a lot of chefs write books, and you don't walk away with a sense of why they chose those recipes or why they're important to them. And I think, I mean, anybody can get a blueberry pancake recipe, but you know, why did you choose it and why is it important?
Yeah, there's a bunch of books, I'm not gonna name names, but by chefs who I'm really interested in, the book comes out and you're just like, oh, okay. It's like, where, I know the chef, I know he or she has a lot of voice personally, and it doesn't make it onto the page because of the writer they worked with. They didn't have that tension maybe that you guys have. Do you let's talk about the recipes, because you're talking about Japanese cooking, and one point you make, Ivan, in the book is that I think a lot of Americans think of Japanese food and they think of, you know, they think of Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and it's like, oh, it's obsessive and it's precise and there's an element of fetishism there. And you make the point like, well, yeah, there is that, but mostly what people eat in Japan is like anywhere. It's a lot of home cooking, and it's food that's probably a lot more accessible.
And quite frankly, it's that way with everything. I mean, you know, with all those fancy cookbooks that have the four-day recipes, even for professional chefs, that's a project you have to put time aside for. In the meantime, you still need to get food on the table for your family. And, you know, this book really turned out to be a journal of all the food I cooked for my family. And you know, I did go back and redo every single recipe. I made myself, you know, Chris would be like, did you time the amount of time it cooked to saute the onions? And I'd be like, oh, no, I didn't. He's like, you got to do it again.
Because home cooks don't do that.
No.
Home cooks just make it. And you're like, was that a large yellow onion or a medium yellow onion? Was that onion?
This is how we ended up with like decades of that classic instruction of like, brown the onions, it'll take about 2 minutes. And you're like, anybody who has ever browned an onion knows that you cannot brown an onion in 2 minutes. You know, like that's the classic thing.
If you look at old cookbooks, like the original Joy of Cooking and stuff going way back, there was an assumption that the cook actually knew how to do stuff. They knew how to make biscuits, but we're just going to tell you, like, in terms of chilling the butter for how long, all that sort of stuff. Like, well, you already know how to do that, so we're just going to walk you through this version of it.
Right.
I think nowadays, as you guys, when you do cookbooks, it's like editors and publishers are always like, well, you can't assume that the reader knows how to do this, and you need to explain that. And then you're like, well, do we need to explain everything? And you're like, yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
But it was really, in a way, it was really fun to sort of sit back and rethink all of these things. Because everything in this book, and I keep telling Chris, I mean, last night I got home, and my wife said, are you hungry, hon? I made curry with the cubes. But she used
talk about that, whether you have to make your own curry or whether it's okay to buy like the little bouillon style cubes. Yeah,
we only use the cubes.
Yeah.
And so she had leftover vegetable soup she made the day before. She made it with the cubes. She had some fried shrimp in the fridge, and I put together dinner.
So your wife is Japanese. In Japan, are the cubes just accepted? Like, yeah, if you're a home cook, that's totally fine.
I mean, they have cubes for cream stew too.
Well, this was the whole point of, to your point, Adam, what you were talking about, it's like, there's this preciousness around Japanese cuisine and culture, and you know, like if you're not wearing the right kimono when you're cooking this thing, like it won't turn out properly.
Do you wear a kimono when you cook, Chris?
Yeah, but I did that before I was cooking Japanese food. I do that all the time. I'm in a kimono right now. But no, that was a hugely important part of the book to me too. Aside from trying to communicate these recipes and getting this out there, was, you know, it was eye opening to me the first few times. The first time I went to Japan with Ivan and sort of learning at his feet has been really eye-opening about Japanese culture, and it was important to me to dispel a lot of that notion that, you know, the Japanese would never use a microwave, or they would never use the curry block cubes, or, you know, like every time they make a dish with potatoes, they harvest it by hand from their, you know, their gardens or something. Like, that's just not that in its own way is, you know, it's reverence for Japanese people, but it's also like a weird pigeonholing of like all Japanese people as this mystical you know,
a lot of the same challenges, like people who work long days, they live in crowded cities, they come home, they need to make some dinner.
Totally.
Quickly.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
You started at the very beginning, I guess, of home cooking. I was interested to learn, you're not a rice cooker person.
I am a rice cooker person. I am actually a rice cooker person. What happened was actually is that I lost faith in rice cookers for a little while. But I think it actually you could translate to be I'm a cheap guy, mm-hmm. and you have to buy the good ones that cost about $500. And ours broke, and so I went ahead and I bought a $150 one, and it just decimated our rice. So for a while, I was using one of those little Staub.
On your nice intro on this. Was it a 1.5-quart rice pot?
Yep. It was like this little heavy-duty, you know, cast iron pot. And I did the one-knuckle method, you know, where you put rice in. And you can put any amount of rice you want as long as the water is covered and the tip of your finger touches the rice and the water stops at your first knuckle. And it works every single time. And I make rice that way.
Sure.
Sure it does. Okay, all right, go ahead.
Sure it does.
It does. What do you mean?
No, it works that way after you've made it a million times.
You have massive knuckles.
No, it works that way after you've made it.
There's a couple of things. I'm a decent cook, but I'm not like an expansive home cook, but I can do some things well. I always fuck up rice.
Yeah.
And I just can't. I'm like, why is it? Did I not stir it enough? Did I not rinse it enough? Was the heat too high?
Well, this is why I think the rice cooker comes in handy for the heat thing. But like this was like, you know, the point of that chapter was, yes, like the knuckle thing works after you've done it a million times. But, you know, I had a weird rice cooking slump too, where like my rice was just like so awful over and over and over again. And finally, when I decided like, I'm just going to measure this every single time. Like my rice is perfect, and like that's kind of the thing. Like I'm giving Ivan a hard time because he is a proponent of the knuckle thing. But like
I just did it the other day; it was perfect, thing. And I used it with long grain rice, and I made like it was perfect.
Sure,
but you're a rice. You have a rice cooker. At home,
I'm trying to like sell our book over here, and I'm just trying to sell his stupid knuckle method.
Are you a rice cooker guy?
I am a rice cooker guy, but I mean the best rice comes out of, you know, the stovetop ones, honestly. Like out of either that Staub thing or like a Donabe makes the best rice. Yeah,
the Donabe with the double lid. Yeah. Those are cool.
It makes perfect rice.
Yeah. And I'll also add that freshly harvested rice. When you're in Japan and you buy the more expensive rice, it's so good. It's so good. So instead of bringing back a kimono from Tokyo, bring back some rice.
Unlike on the Western side though, you do not salt the rice in Japan, correct?
No.
No. No. Never.
No, why would you? It tastes really good
know.
The way it is.
Well,
it doesn't need any help.
Oh, gosh.
See, man? This is what I'm talking about. Low-level bickering 24 hours a day.
I was, I got really hungry. There's the recipe in here. I don't know if it was one of your kids' recipes. You were talking about the crispy pork cutlets, but you make like the sauce. You make the cutlets flowered and then fried, and then make the sauce and put them back in there.
Right?
Can we talk about that one?
Yeah,
that made me really hungry. What's that one called? For some reason,
Katsudon. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's essentially a crispy pork cutlet that's then finished in onions and dashi and scrambled and whipped up eggs that you cook.
Well, there's that one, the katsudon, I know that one, but no, there's another one was like you cut 12 pieces of pork tenderloin, pound it,
right,
flour it, fry it, and then you've got like kind of a mirin soy thing, and you put the cutlets back in the pan.
Oh, the shogayaki.
Sauce. Oh, shogayaki. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's, but that's flour, I think.
Flour.
So not, what's going not,
on? Yeah, so that oh, one.
So that is like, that is probably in my top three all-time dishes that we eat like at least four times a month
that's
in my house.
That's what you wrote in the intro. And I'm like, I want to make that four times a month.
You could make it. It's so easy.
So what do? Do you buy a pork tenderloin and then cut it up yourself?
First of all, you can use a pork tenderloin. You can use a pork loin. It's nice to pound it out a little bit. You know, to me, one real pro tip is that tenderloin, because you cut them and then you pound them. And so you break the fibers a bit and it's already pretty tender.
Yeah.
And so it comes out real nice.
And pretty thin. You said about a quarter of an inch.
Yeah, yeah.
And just dust it in flour, dredge it in flour.
Yep.
But seriously, oil wise, that's always interesting in terms of oil. But are you just like a basic neutral oil?
I'm just a canola oil guy, generally speaking, and I usually have a. Actually, lately I've been buying like really premium sesame oil, and I always squiggle a little bit of that in there, and it gives a nice little perfume without going too heavy. But that is a lovely dish,
and kids love it. You fry it up, you take the cutlets out, and then into the pan goes what?
Into the pan goes. That one has onions and teriyaki sauce poured over the top, and you Yeah?
Ginger. No. It's like a super ginger.
Oh, it's ginger, and then you add a lot of ginger. Yes, I don't know.
Cool, man. Shaking his head cool. over there. And then you. And then
Ivan's
you,
never made these recipes in his life.
And then you put the cutlets back in the pan with the sauce, kind of like smothered pork chop style.
It's totally like smothered pork chops. Like smothered pork chops. And like smothered pork chops is like the only analog, I think, in like known kind of American cuisine that like that does this thing of. That you'll see in a lot of, I mean, Japanese food, but a lot of other Asian cuisines where you take this like crispy fried thing and then just like douse it with liquid.
Yeah.
Emil Stonick at Bon Appetit, he did a whole essay about that, the crispy soggy phenomenon of sometimes with Chinese food, sometimes with like Italian American, where you get like the chicken francese sort of thing and then the sauce goes over it.
Totally.
And it's crispy and soggy all at the same time. And you're like,
chicken francese is one of the greats.
Oh, it's so great.
Oh my God.
There's a fine line sometimes between Chinese American cuisine and Italian American cuisine.
Yeah,
when you
for
get
sure.
to the chicken cutlet portion of the menu.
But that's like that's the whole thing, right? Is like these universally delicious things that like cut across these borders. Like that's a huge part of. And it's weird. Just like, I mean, like Bon Appetit is a magazine and like all of your media reaches everybody in the country. I'm sure like this is not a surprise to you, but like it's been really surprising putting this book out to me, like how unfamiliar people are with Japanese food. Like I'm sure with an audience, like a huge audience like you have, like you realize like not everybody lives in New York, not everybody lives in San Francisco or LA. Like you sometimes have to introduce these ideas, and like it's been eye-opening for us. Like,
well, you guys sort of grapple with the notion of ingredients and like, okay, there's a lot of things that you can get at a basic grocery store these days. Some things that you're going to have to go online to order, or maybe if you do have an Asian market in your city you can go to, and you have a sort of a glossary in the back. And it's always that question of like, how specific and specialized do we want to get? Or at what instances can we say, you know what, we can actually leave that out and the recipe will still be fine. Mm-hmm. How did you sort of deal with that?
Well, there's only really five ingredients. I mean, it's a soy sauce and meat in, which is the seasoned rice wine.
Ivan, you have like an 8-page like glossary in the back with like 48 ingredients.
Yeah,
did he work on this book?
This is the first time he's ever seen this book.
He's still waiting on his galley.
You can do it with sake, meat in, soy, sugar, and katsuobushi. You're most of the way there.
Yeah, most of the time. I had that issue with my editors. It's always like, if you have too many ingredients in a recipe, when the reader looks at it, and this, I kind of go back to my days when I was at GQ, if they see a suit that costs $2,000, they're just going to turn the page.
Right.
And if someone sees a recipe with too many ingredients, they're just like, I'm never going to make that.
Yeah, I used to cherish being a pain in the ass about that stuff. You know, like people would ask for a substitute for chrysanthemum greens, and I'd be like, no, you'll die if you make this with anything except for chrysanthemum greens. But, you know, I mean, to Ivan's point, you can order everything in this book from Amazon or any sort of online retailer, with the exception of mentaiko, like spicy cod roe. But, you know, it to be totally honest with you, it didn't come up that often. Like, there weren't recipes that Ivan was sending me that were like 6-day projects with 400 ingredients, 3 of which he had brought back from Japan, 1 of which was alive. Like, none, that didn't happen.
You did sort of cordon off that one section of the obsessive sort of
totally.
Projects. Yeah. If you want to go and do make your own homemade this and that and roll them out, yada, yada, you can. And here's a little section. Otherwise, everything else. What I liked about the book also is, as you allude to in the book, so many Japanese cookbooks, there is that sort of air of like reverence and almost austerity. Here's lots of shots of you and your kids and wife and like literally like the kitchen table.
But I don't know. Maybe I'm just a loser. I don't cook and I don't cook any of that stuff. I mean, maybe all these chefs.
But that's
really
why you go to a restaurant.
Yeah.
No one cooks that stuff at
home. I totally agree. And every once in a while I'll crank up my smoker and I'll do something all day long and I do it. It's fun, but I don't cook. I mean, I come home. I never have my head spinning around with kids and jobs and deadlines. And I mean, who has time to sit and do all
that stuff?
This is
what we talk
about
is like when we're at home cooking, it's like, how do I minimize the number of dishes I have to do later? Yeah. And like, how do I keep things clean and use the least utensils?
And have it be delicious.
And have it be delicious. And like, that's why that didn't come up that often. Like, I used to be like the biggest snob about this stuff. And I realized like there's nothing more useful or noble or important than helping people put food on the table, which is like, you know, I think that 3-4 years ago I would have been like, who cares about that? Like, that's not who I want
to
talk to.
It's like, I always say, you know, give people a reason to make this recipe. don't give them reason to not make it.
And it's generally
and
that.
And if no one cooks the recipe, what's the point of putting all those ingredients
in? And I think it's also that,
I wish
you know,
that you had just said that to me when we were at Lucky Peach, man. Just like put that on a wall somewhere, you know.
But no, back then there was way too many ingredients in Bon Appetit recipes too, and I was just yelling at my editors all the time, and they weren't listening to me.
Well, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, there's always going to be people when some famous chef does a really geeky book, and the people who buy it might really enjoy it. It's fun to read those books.
But yeah, they have a totally different value.
And that's not the book we wanted. We wanted to have a very broad book. We wrote our first book together. It was super niche. It did quite well, and I think people enjoyed it. And once again, even in that book, I tried so very hard to say, hey, we're not like busting on you. Here's how to hack this, and here, you don't have to have this perfect ingredient. If you don't have it, substitute this or that. Don't worry about it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of don't worry about stuff, because I like when people cook. I'm so, you know, I'm so happy when I hear people enjoyed themselves in their home. And it's like, look, don't worry about it. Just if you don't have it, I posted on Instagram the other day that I did one of our recipes. I did our buta kimchi, right? The pork with the kimchi.
I was about to ask about that.
And
one,
I didn't have any green cabbage, so I used Napa cabbage, and I didn't have enough raw pork, but I had like all this leftover tenderloin that I barbecued.
Beef, so we just do that.
Yeah, but you know what? It works. It just works, and you end up having it so much better than ordering out.
Yeah, I think that's always any good recipe should serve as a template for a dish. It does not need to be like Xerox directly. Like, yeah, if you can't have this cabbage, get that cabbage. You know, you'll figure it out.
The only problem is always like, do you ever get this one where it's like, this recipe sucked. Oh, yeah. It was like awful. It was so bad. Like the, you know, it's like this, it's the buta kimchi. It's pork belly with cabbage or with kimchi. And I made it. It was awful. This magazine sucks. This book sucks. I mean, I did have to substitute pheasant for cabbage.
And I did use tofu instead of pork belly because I'm vegetarian.
And I didn't have kimchi, so I used egg noodles. Like, I was like, what?
My favorite bad review of Ivan Ramen of all time was that someone said it was the worst Thai book they ever bought.
Which I agree with. It's the worst Thai cookbook.
Ivan, do I need a donabi in my life?
You certainly do not need a donabi in your life, but if you happen to find a place where they're selling one, or if you're in Japan and you see a beautiful shop, I mean, they're lovely and they last forever. My donabi I bought 25 or 30 years ago, and I still use it, and it's...
What do you like about it compared to like a basic Staub or Le Creuset sort of pot?
I mean, I personally think they're quite similar. They're more porous, so they behave a little differently than cast iron, but they do similar things that cast iron does. You know, it holds heat, and what it does better than cast iron is they're more beautiful. Bring them to the table. I mean, we didn't talk about cooking at the table in this book, but I mean, in my home, and especially when I lived in Japan, everybody in Japan has a little gas burner that they can put on their table.
We were literally just talking about that in an ideas meeting today, and with hot pot, shabu shabu, that sort of stuff. And you're always like, well, to who... In America, at least, not that many people will have the little burner they can bring to the table.
Right, but they sell them everywhere. Cool, and once again, with the advent of internet shopping, I mean, it's a click away.
The whole donabi section, I mean, yeah, chicken and vegetable rice, pork and miso ginger stew, pork and root vegetable stew with shirataki noodles. I mean, I would eat that. I would eat that. But also that notion of looking at these dishes, what I liked about them was like, I would eat that and I could totally make that. You know?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully that's the thing.
And what's also fun is that, once again, we do all these interactive things. We have the tamaki sushi party. We have the instant ramen party. And while we didn't really touch on this because of, to your point, that people don't really have these burners in their homes and we didn't want to complicate anything, the donabes are also the same thing. You know, you have in an Asian home, and I'll say in an Asian home, not just in Japan, but across Asia, I think you come to the table with vegetables and meat and broth and you have everything simmering and then everybody eats. And then as it disappears, you just add more stuff and put the lid back on and you keep eating. And then when you lift the lid off, everything's cooked again. Mm-hmm. And you just keep eating all night and adding things and then pulling it out. It's really fun. It's a great, maybe that's the next cookbook.
It's a shabu shabu.
I want a piece. How many years did you live in Japan? Off and on?
Off and on for about 17, 18 years, something like that.
So let's say you're going to Tokyo next month. What's the first thing you like to eat once you get there and wake up and,
oh my God,
and get through your intermittent fast?
Well, the first thing is I always stay at my relax. I always stay at my friend's house, our best friends in Tokyo, and she almost always will. We always get there late. and she always has something spectacular that's very like a bowl of natto gohan, which is, you know, the fermented soybeans.
Oh, you talked about that.
Yeah, but then
took you a while to come around to that one, right?
25 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
But but then she, the last time we were there, you know, she put this in front of us and she chopped up some myoga, which is sort of a family, the ginger family. It's a very aromatic root vegetable, and a raw, gorgeous orange egg on top. And I was just like, okay, this is, I mean, I don't need anything else. This is so good, you know? And then we go from there, you know, we always hit up a couple of our popular ramen shops. And, my wife loves this chain that does sort of a Salisbury steak kind of thing. And it's in a foil bag with demi-glace and mushrooms. And they bring it to the table on a sizzling platter. And they, you know, you pull it open and this thing is just bubbling. And it's just, it's kind of crap. It's like a, you know, $12 dish. But it's so good. And we go almost every trip, we go there. And they're all over Tokyo, you know, there's 100 of them. But it's so good.
You're old enough to remember the TV dinners of the 70s.
Well, thank you. That's why I'm a cook.
Yeah.
Because my mother would say, my daddy and I are going to the ballet. We left you hungry man dinner in the freezer. And in 1976, you'd throw them in there, and one half would be ice cold, and the other half would be molten.
But you would get that bubbly cherry dessert thing, cobbler. Yep. Chris, you're a California guy. Don't act like you've ever had a TV dinner. Foraging your own mushrooms in Golden Gate Park or something. And the mashed potatoes that are like super creamy with the butter melted on top.
Yep. That is exactly why I cook professionally.
Yeah, even at the time I knew that the Salisbury steak was disgusting, but it was disgusting in a good way.
Maybe for you.
Yeah. What about the egg yolks? I'm looking at this beef and onion rice ball gyudon, which I want to eat right now.
It's so good.
And there's the raw egg yolk on top.
Well, Chris and I come from the school of thought that an egg yolk on something makes everything better, but you know, I really do. I mean, it just adds to the sauce and makes it richer and creamier and delicious.
And the notion, crack it or pierce it and then sort of mix it in.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. The book is out now?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. It's like, I don't
know. 2 days
ago. Yeah, okay. I still have the black and white copy. Chris, you haven't sent me an actual copy yet.
I was feeling pretty bad about it just now.
I mean, it looks delicious, but in black and white on a Xerox page of piece of paper, it's only so delicious. Is this what we call ugly delicious, Chris? Is that how this works?
Oh, no. That is what, ugly delicious this next season will be in black and white.
Okay, that'd be a good idea. Or just brown. Just brown and white.
Actually, everybody would be performing behind a screen.
Yeah, just in sepia tones.
All right, before we let you go, book's out now. Ivan Rahman, Chris Yang. We're going to do lightning round questions, either or, vaguely sort of Japanese related.
Okay.
And you got to answer. Ready?
Do my best. Yeah.
All right. Ultraman or Godzilla?
Godzilla.
Wow. Yeah, Godzilla.
I'm an Ultraman guy.
I was never a big Ultraman.
Really? With the beta capsule? I mean, turns into Ultraman?
None of my kids aren't Ultraman people either.
Wow. All right. Fine.
Yeah, there's some real judgment in this lightning round.
Yeah. Egg salad sando or pork katsu sando?
Oh, my God.
Got to choose one.
I'm going to go pork.
No, I'm egg salad all the way.
Yeah.
Heavy egg salad guy.
Yeah. It's almost equal, but...
Yeah.
Put them together.
It's a very simple one. The recipe is just basically eggs, salt, and mayonnaise. Do you add anything to when you're eating it, Chris?
I don't. I just go straight. I mean, like nice eggs and Kewpie mayo. That's it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, salt. The key is the eggs.
Yeah. And the Kewpie. It's got to be Kewpie.
Do you buy into the hype of the egg salad sando at Konbi in LA?
I haven't had it yet, but we're doing a pop up there. And I'm super excited.
Oh, cool! So you guys together?
We're doing it. Oh. We're doing it.
It's great. I met them at Feast in Portland last week.
Yeah, exactly.
And really nice.
You were there.
Yeah, really nice guys, and we're excited. They're just really nice.
I mean, it's the single most beautiful thing I've seen in like 3 years.
They are number one restaurant in America. Our Hot 10 list, which came out last week, and big giant centerfold, close up centerfold of that sandwich. I was like, is that a bit much? And my artist was like, no, it's amazing. It's macro. I'm like, it's really in your face. They're like, no, you don't get it. It's a different way of looking at the Instagram that everyone's seen a million times, and this is a different approach. It's like, okay. I'm going to trust you on this one. Aisle or window?
Aisle.
Window, man.
Dude, really?
I have to lean on something to sleep.
So you fall, you lean.
Oh, my God.
That's what everyone says about the window. They want to kind of lean on it to fall asleep.
Yeah. My whole life is based on how I'm going to pee when I need to.
Oh, that's what I said. My bad. I got it. Do you raise your hand, Emma? You agreed on that one? Yeah. I drink a lot of water on the plane, so I'm constantly getting up.
Oh, but I love bothering
Although
two people
Chris,
to get up.
Chris, who made my United Airlines seat arrangements has me right in the middle, which is lovely.
I move away from you. Too.
Nothing worse in the middle.
So I'm like just I'm in between probably two people who just finished having like garlic stew or something.
All right, when in Tokyo, cold sake or cold beer?
Cold beer.
Do you have a favorite?
Asahi.
Okay, Chris.
Yeah, there's nothing better than that.
Oh, actually, Asahi in America, Suntory when I'm in Japan.
All right. And the little glasses poured in there?
I like No. Draft.
Draft.
Okay. Draft all the way.
Oh, wow. It's got to come out of the machine.
Right. So it's ice cold.
Yes, and we're getting one of those machines. So.
All right, Chris, this is for you. Ivan Orkin or David Chang?
This is so messed up, man. Just give me one more qualification. Ivan Orkin or David Chang in what context?
Do you have one to work with the rest of your life?
David Chang's made me a lot more money. I'm sorry, Ivan. Dave's made me a lot more money.
Jet lag in Tokyo or jet lag back home?
Well, jet lag in Tokyo. Jet lag's only mildly dealable if you're on vacation and you have a reason to have to suck it up. Mm-hmm. Once you're home, then you're like you're back at work.
What's happening? I don't.
Where would you rather have the jet lag?
I was thinking about Dave and Ivan again. Yeah. How much trouble I'm going to be in now. I'd rather have jet lag. I'd rather have jet lag in Japan, honestly, because you just
roll with
you're
it.
There and you fight through it.
Yeah.
Lawson's or 7-Eleven?
You know, 7-Eleven has better desserts.
We're talking Japan, Tokyo, by the way, America, yes.
Yeah, 7-Eleven has sick desserts. They do all their own custom desserts, and they're really good. Lawson's has, like, really good sandwiches and onigiri.
Yeah, he's my Konbini Mart Sherpa, so I go with him.
Bourbon whiskey or Japanese whiskey?
Oh, bourbon whiskey.
Hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Americans, they have an edge there.
Yeah.
Lost in Translation or Isle of Dogs, both featuring Bill Murray.
Oh, Isle of Dogs. Isle of Dogs. Isle of 100. You know, Lost in Translation, I don't totally get, like, I have not
watched it in over a decade, so I'm curious how
it
holds up.
Well, I watched it recently, and I mean, the fact is that I've always been a Japan geek for a long time. So for a lot of people, Lost in Translation was their entry into everything Japanese, where it wasn't mine. I recently saw Isle of Dogs in the theater. Actually, I saw it in Kichijoji in this really funky, creepy, dirty little theater in Tokyo. And I was just like over the moon. I thought it was so brilliant.
All right, a couple more. Pizza in Tokyo or pasta in Tokyo?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
They're both really good.
I mean, I guess I would say pizza in Tokyo because I have a few spots that I like. I really feel special about when I go there. It's very Japan, and yet it's very comforting.
Are they all generally more Neapolitan style, where you get the whole pie?
No, the place I like right now, the slices they still don't do.
Yeah.
My favorite place right now is Pizza Studio Tamaki, which is sort of a hybrid. I'm not a big Neapolitan guy. I can't. I mean, I respect it because I think good Neapolitan pizza tastes like good bread, and I like it. But it's too wet. And I just, as a New Yorker, I just can't get my head around it.
The center gets too wet, and you have that giant bumbly-style crust on the outside. It's like you're eating a donut. And I'm like, it's a little much. I don't know. I'm like, I'll stop. I'll get myself in trouble.
Me too. But like I said, I'll throw in that I respect people who make it well. Yeah. And it's just that I prefer, I'm just a New Yorker. I prefer a different style pizza. But try PST next time you're in. It's real good.
Chris?
I haven't had pizza in Tokyo, but for the first time I had pasta there, and it wasn't, you know, the pasta we had is the one we include in the book, which is this spaghetti Neapolitan, which is ketchup spaghetti.
It is the greatest thing ever.
And I loved it.
Was that the recipe where you're saying if I was on social media right now, I'd be getting an earful from
yeah,
all sorts of people?
Basically, it's sacrilege. It's Italian sacrilege, but it's so delicious. And, you know, we went to a little place in Tokyo and had it together last time, and it was just, you go downstairs and everybody's wearing, it's just coming straight from their work, and they're all wearing these like perfectly crisp white shirts and just scarfing down spaghetti with Tabasco and grated Parmesan out of the green
Kraft
can.
It's a Kisaten special, you know. It's a cafe special, and it's super old school. And Chris is right, and then it comes out in this like ridiculous portion. You're like, what? Like that's like two boxes of spaghetti. What is?
And you think it's like a joke. You think it's just like, oh, this is like a parody of America because it has like a little iceberg lettuce salad on the side with ranch dressing.
Yep.
And like people just scarf it down, and it's crazy. They just walk out without not a single speck on their shirts. It's like unbelievable.
I always have a spec or five.
Yeah.
Final questions, because we always ask this and has nothing to do with Tokyo. Butter or olive oil?
Butter.
Yeah, butter. Is that a, who says olive oil? Are you olive oil?
It's not about me, Chris.
Oh, man. He's olive oil. I don't understand.
Chris Ying, Ivan Orkin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Carly, you ready?
I'm so ready.
Number 10.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just going to call it. Well, you didn't put numbers. But
I didn't.
All right. So I'm starting from the bottom.
Great.
Embrace fat.
Oh, yeah. I say this all the time. Fat is not just flavor. You have to remember that fat is a cooking medium. If you don't have enough fat in the pan, you are not conducting heat from the surface to the pan, of the pan, to the element in the dish. So the fat becomes part of the heat source.
You're getting all Harold McGee on me.
Yeah, just remember that. You need fat in the pan.
And there's nothing worse than not having enough fat. And then, like, especially if you're ever trying to do, we're talking about this on one of the other roads, when you're trying to do like chicken cutlets with like breading, and if there's not enough oil in the pan, they get all just kind of dry and scorched. And
it's like a combination of, yes, soggy and scorched.
It's the worst.
Bad.
It's bad all around.
Fat.
Huh. Number 9. Zone out your fridge.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in like having things in the same place all the time. And I do this in many areas of my kitchen, but also in the refrigerator, so that you don't have to search around as much. If the buttermilk is always in the dairy area of the refrigerator, if I don't see it there, then that means I don't have it.
Yeah.
I don't have to go like rooting around, you know what I mean? So I even like to have like condiments on a certain shelf and leftovers. Obviously you'd need to jigsaw a little bit depending on what you're fitting, but I hate it when the milk's on the wrong side.
I need to do this because like, I literally opened my fridge last night and my chest started to tighten.
Yeah.
I was like, there was just so much crap all over the place and I couldn't see anything. And I knew stuff had been in there from like takeout from a week ago. And like I was just like,
Messy bed, messy head, man.
It was. And then I don't want to get into marriage therapy right now, but,
no, but
it's an issue.
I'm with you.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
100% with you.
All right, number 7. No, number 8. Sorry. If you would put numbers on these, Carla,
I
would know.
I'm sorry.
Okay, number 8. Treat your oven nice.
Yeah, so I'm really guilty of this, and it's something that I need to do better on. I learned this from Rick Martinez, food editor, extraordinaire. A clean oven reflects heat so much better than a non-clean one. And so when
emailing myself. I've never cleaned my oven.
Me neither.
I don't even know how to. Just do the oven setting?
One of those like degreasers. It depends what kind of oven you have. But usually there's like those foam cleaners or oven cleaner. I'm sure people are going to be like, I'm sure there's like ones that are nicer for the world than others, but they're degreasers. You put them on, they come off. I'm sure in my case, I'm going to need like a chisel and a frickin' like pastry scraper, but.
What about those things like the self-cleaning oven? Like where you turn it on a special thing and it goes
to
8 zillion degrees.
And that carbonizes any like remnants that are in there. But what I didn't know was that the surfaces of the oven are shiny and that their quality reflects heat all around, so your oven's gonna operate better.
Yeah, my oven sucks right now.
It's
bumming me out. Okay.
Really?
Seriously, it's a problem. My oven, my refrigerator. I guess like I'm not even gonna get into the home office, which is a disaster.
It's another pod.
All right. Number seven, buy a black steel pan.
Yeah, I really love my black steel pan. I've written about it over the years and from here to there. So black steel is an iron, you know, a thin iron pan. So it's like they're often sold as crepe pans. And it has all the heat conductivity of a cast iron at like a third of the weight.
Yeah, and it's kind of a whereas some cast irons newer that sort of nubbiness,
exactly.
These are really smooth and shiny when you buy them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they're very slick and they seem thin in a, like they're too thin, but they have incredible heat retention and heat conductivity. I use mine all the time.
Yeah, I have a little one that I use for like perfect for two like fried eggs that sort of merge together,
yes,
you know, and
totally.
It slides right out. What is there a brand or anything
I
you
like
recommend?
I'm going to mispronounce it, but it's Bourget. It's Bourget.
Okay.
It's a French brand. You can find them online, and they're really affordable.
Yeah, they're very French, this sort of pan. As you
Try
said,
French.
Kind of a crepe sort of thing.
Yeah.
Have a favorite dish? Question mark. Cook it forever. What the hell? What are you talking about?
So I think that people have this idea that if they make something good, then they're like, okay, good. I have that good recipe. And then always trying some new recipe and changing in, you know, like always wanting to do something new. I am a big believer. Make the same thing. If it's great, make it for the rest of your life.
Okay, so can I, this is like something when I was growing up in the district back in the 70s and early 80s, like we would not go out to dinner that much.
Right.
So there was like a handful of restaurants in rotation for the Rappaports. And we'd go to them, you know, probably you go to the same restaurant once every 4 months. And I'd often go to a restaurant, I'm like, oh, I'm going to get the, you know, that pasta dish with the grilled chicken. And my dad goes like, what? You always order the same thing. Why don't you try something different? I'm like, Dad, I go here once every 4 months. I like that dish a lot. I want that dish because I haven't had it in 4 months.
Right.
So it's not like I always order the same thing. I've had 90 meals in between. I would like that dish.
I'm a big believer in yes, this practice in restaurants as well. I go to restaurants because I want that thing that they have. That thing you do. I've also sort of realized this as a home cook, that there's things that I make that I love, and I love making them, and I love how they taste, and I love that they fit the right situation or the scenario, and you turn to them over and over again, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's the perfect pair of pants. You don't need a different pair.
Just for the sake of
getting a different pair.
As fall approaches,
yeah.
You know what I'm going to be making?
Tell me.
Carlo's duck confit.
There you go.
It's happening.
Perfect example.
Deal with it. Deal with it. All right, I think it's number five. I've lost track. Shop first, decide what to make second.
Yeah, I feel like I've talked about this quite a few times when we've talked about my book, Where Cooking Begins. I think that this is like rule number one. Even though I put it in the middle of the list, just get out of the habit of picking your recipe and then going shopping. If you go shopping, you will see what looks great. You will decide what makes you feel hungry. You will get in the mood for something. You will buy the best quality thing that is available instead of walking in with a recipe and then hunting around for ingredients that may or may not be like the best thing that store has on offer.
Will you do this? I think I do this sometimes, actually. Like, I was at the market, the farm stand, a few weeks ago when it was still summer, and saw all these amazing, cool eggplants, like the Japanese ones and the little round ones and the big ones. And I'm like, oh, I got to buy eggplant.
They're irresistible.
And then what I did was I had my phone. I Googled Bon Appetit space eggplant.
Yeah.
I didn't go to bonappetit.com and search for eggplant.
You would never find
it. God forbid you search for anything on our website.
You would find oven temperature.
Are you listening? Are you listening, Kanye Nast Tech Department? Do not cut that, Emma. I hope they are listening. But so then I saw like oh yeah, there's that miso glazed one. Okay, then I'm gonna make sure. Well, maybe I don't have miso, but I have this. I can basically riff on it that
exactly.
way. Or this one has fresh mint, and I'm at the market. They've got fresh mint, and I'm gonna grill it. And I'm gonna do yada yada.
Yeah.
I think
decide in the moment,
yeah.
And decide when the food is in front of you, and do exactly what Adam just said.
Okay, I do not do this. Shop the bulk bin, but don't do big batch cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do either, but so talk to me.
Okay, well, the bulk bin is like one of my favorite places in the world, no matter what part of the world I'm in. So I have this thing when I go to other cities, I'll like go to the health food store, the New Seasons or the Berkeley Bowl or like wherever.
There's
and just
no
like,
place more depressing than like health food stores from like the 80s, 90s.
No, there's so no more.
And what is that smell? You walk in, there's that weird smell kind of like, what is that smell? It doesn't smell like food. It smells like kind of, it's not quite stale.
It smells like quiet rebellion.
It smells like,
and I love it.
It smells like powdered things. It smells like dried things. And I'm like, people, you need to live a little.
Okay, when you buy food.
Like Integral Yoga over on West 13th Street.
It smells like
hate that place.
Hope and, you know, counterculture.
It smells like a steam table. Oh, God. So anyways.
It smells like socks and sandals. And that's
lentils. Lots of lentils.
Okay. So I really enjoy that environment. What I love about bulk bins also is that it's usually the same thing, like rice, beans, dried fruit, that you, nuts especially, that you would find packaged from, like, you know, whatever brand. But it's just going to cost less per pound when you pull down the lever yourself and get your little twist tie out.
Do you think they're fresher because?
I do. I think the turnover is higher and they're in that little hermetically sealed thing and they're just getting replenished. Plus, it's fun and you can let your kid use the scale.
That's true. Next question before we move on to number four. Do you then, when you get home.
Jars.
Yeah, so you then transfer it to.
We have a huge jar party.
Okay, yeah, we need some of those too.
And labels. Then you bust out the Sharpie, the masking tape.
Nope, don't have those in my disorganized
kitchen. I made my
son,
my younger son, Cosmo, I had some frozen blueberries. I had blueberries that were going to go bad, so I froze them. And then I was putting them from the little tray into a pint container. Mm-hmm. This was this morning. And I was like, Cos, here's some masking tape. Write frozen blueberries on this and put it in the fridge. And he was like, he goes, it's with the pen in his hand, he's like, blue is spelled. And I was like, you're in fourth grade. Like, what in the hell? I was like, dude, blue. And he was like, B-L-O.
Oh, Jesus. But then you also say, but don't do big batch cooking with your bulk bin purchases.
Yeah. So I buy, this was just me sort of in my little twisted way saying, you know, buy things that are sold in bulk. But when you're cooking, actually, I really don't believe in batch cooking. I know it works for some people, but like meal prep or like making a 8x recipe of something and then having it in the fridge for like 5 days and like, you know what? You don't want that.
I don't like those people. Who are these people?
I just buy what you're going to eat in like the next 3 to 4 days and finish it and then move on.
No, but in all seriousness, I don't hate it.
I did a lot of big batch cooking when I had tiny toddlers.
Yeah, I will say this. So like, I don't big batch because I'm too disorganized, but it is nice sometimes where I've made a really nice pot of beans that really well seasoned, like, and I'll put a few like pint containers in the freezer and then on like a week and a half later, like, oh yeah, I've got those pinto beans. You take them out and heat them up and you're like, you add that to that one other thing you're making and all of a sudden.
But that's like a component thing, not a meal.
No,
like
making
a 20 cup batch of chili.
This is a weird one. Always buy knives in person.
Yeah, I think people buy chef's knives and slicing knives and paring knives and stuff online a lot because we just buy a lot of things online. I really, really recommend going to a store where you can pick a knife up, feel it, hold it, get the weight of it, see how it fits in your hand, make sure that the length of the blade feels natural for you. That's like when you're cooking, that's an extension. That's your tool. That's like 100%. That's what you're using. And I thought that this was so sort of romantic and overblown when the first person said this to me. It was one of the sous chefs at one of my very first line cook jobs. And he... I got my first Japanese knife and he was like, your relationship to the ingredient is going to like be totally different. And I was like, oh my God, that's like really extreme. And then I got this knife
he was probably hanging out at Integral Yoga.
And I was like, wow, I feel like I'm in control. It was just in a different way.
Yeah. And you only know that until you pick it up and like, maybe some people like a knife to be heavier. Some people want a lighter one. Is that handle? What's the shape of the handle? Does it fit your palm?
Yeah, like there's all those knives things matter. That like, Brad Leone loves and uses every day that I pick them up and I'm like, this just feels, I feel like, you know, I'm picking up the giant's knife.
Yeah,
and he has giant meat hands.
Meaty hands. He's like a giant character from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. And if I ordered that online, I would be like, oh, it looks totally cool.
Brad told me to get it.
Brad told me to get it.
Don't cook with headphones on, parens, but definitely get into podcasts.
So people forget that they need to use their ears. And I think that I figured this out because I have a galley kitchen and my prep area is opposite my cooktop. So a lot of times I have something going in the pan and I have to turn around and turn my back to the stove to go back to my cutting board. And so I rely a lot on hearing.
Yeah.
I know when the water's boiling. I know when the fat is sizzling. I know when something starts to sound dry or whatever it is. I could, last night I could hear the potatoes like crisping up in the oven. And people, washing dishes with your headphones in is probably okay. But if you're noise canceling, you're going to miss like half the experience of cooking.
Yeah, when I'm home, I wear my headphones all the time, everywhere. Now I'm one of those persons on the subway walking down the street. But when I'm home, it's kind of it's a moment to sort of take them off.
Yeah.
And I still, yeah, I agree. I love to listen to something, whether it's music or a podcast while cooking, especially if I'm by myself. But yeah, I like to have the headphones out. Yeah, you cook with your senses.
Yeah.
The smell, sight,
ear, I think people think hearing. About looking and smelling and touching, but they forget that like cooking is very auditory.
Okay, number one, I'm going to read this, but I'm going to preface this by saying, Carl, we do need to sell subscriptions to this magazine. And you yes. can subscribe to Bon Appetit by going to emmabonappetit.com/getthemag.
Nice.
You get an awesome deal for like, I don't know, like super affordable.
It's like $1 a
I know, it's ridiculous.
Minute,
so support what we do. Honestly, we appreciate it so much because everything we talk about in this podcast comes from the magazine, all the recipes, all the everything. It starts with the magazine. So if you want to support us, please subscribe to the magazine. It costs like $1 an issue. Bonappetit.com, get the mag. And with that, your number one rule, stop relying on recipes.
Yeah, I just think that as much as I love recipes, and it is literally my job.
You literally wrote a cookbook.
I literally wrote a cookbook.
And you're working on another, just
and,
remind you.
You know, Bon Appetit is filled with recipes. We publish about 40 every month. But I think if you're a cook, if you want to really cook, free yourself up from the recipe, the shackle of the recipe, and just cook in the moment. You talk about this all the time. You were joking about it the other day. You were like, okay, well, the number one thing about me is I don't follow the recipes. I just like get in there, man, and start cooking. And I think that once recipes are great to teach you how to cook and give you confidence, but you should also like cook without recipes. Yeah.
I like the notion of using recipes as a suggestion, not as a rule. That
right.
Like, hey, like that miso glazed, you know, eggplant that I made the other day. Well, I didn't have miso, so I'm like, well, I don't have that, but I can probably use this. And I don't have fresh mint, but I do have fresh basil, and I can approximate the same vibe on the grill and yada yada. And it was delicious.
Yeah, and when you start learning techniques and feeling more confident about your ability to take something from a raw state to a cooked state, like, do that. Just do it. Do it on your own. Season it up. Taste it. It's all good.
All good. And with that, Carla Music, your 10 cooking rules. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.